Those of you who have chosen to remain with us, thanks for that. The title of our panel is The Scientist as Dramatic Character, and the panelists are Russell Vandenbroek, who is Chair of Theater Arts at the University of Louisville, Lauren Gunderson, who is a writer, a playwright, and an actress, and whose play Sus Manos is now in New York, Brian Richardson, who is a professor of English at the University of Maryland, and Chris Smith, who is artistic director of the Magic Theater in San Francisco. I'll begin by what I'm going to do is to touch on some very, very basic aspects of dramatic character, and talk about dramatic character rather in the abstract rather than in the particular. And one thing that I'm going to endeavor to do is to contrast the idea of dramatic character with that of narrative character or character in the novel. And I think we spent a lot of time yesterday dealing with some of the more narrative aspects. And I'd like to take pains to, in a way, look at the obvious today by way of saying, okay, theatrical character is a different phenomenon, qualitatively different phenomenon from narrative character or from character as conceived in a novel. All that one needs to belong to the dramatic character club is that you be in a play. You be part of the dramatis personae. That is your qualification. Now, Hamlet is a dramatic character. In more ways than one, I guess. But then so is the first murderer in Macbeth. So is the second murderer in Macbeth. And so is Mr. Smith in Eugene Ionesco's play, The Bald Soprano, who has one of my favorite lines in all of drama. Take a circle, caress it, and it will turn vicious. So you don't have to make sense to be a dramatic character, you just have to be in the play. Now, again, I think that in a way, in a very real way, to look closely at dramatic character is to scrutinize the obvious. And I think a big reason for this is the fact that playwrights go to great lengths to disguise the art. They want the character to look natural, like us. They are very much after verisimilitude and characterization to prevent that very jarring experience that occurs in life as well as the theater of being out of character. The dramatic character is very, very distinct from literary or narrative character in the sense of, well, as Shakespeare put it, strutting and fretting his hour upon the stage. So dramatic character exists in a frame of time, and it's a very short time as well, the time limit of the play, and indeed in the now. So as we experience the character on the stage, we're in the moment of present time with that person. Now, this is not at all to say, and let me make this distinction, that we do not know dramatic characters by reading. I mean, as I'm sure you are, am familiar with hundreds of dramatic characters, and most of them I know by reading them. And you can pick up a play and read a bit of it and then go back to it later. But dramatic character is meant for the stage and meant for stage time. Another aspect of character, again, very basic, is that drama shows. The intent of drama is to show rather than to describe or to narrate. As the philosopher and esthetician Suzanne Langer puts it, dramatic action is future directed. As literature creates a virtual past, drama creates a virtual future. The literary mode is the mode of memory. The dramatic is the mode of destiny. So then, here again is a fundamental difference between dramatic characters, say Niels Bohr, or a novelistic character, and I like the example of Holden Caulfield. Do you remember Holden Caulfield? Do we remember Holden Caulfield? We do. I always worry that we've forgotten Holden Caulfield. You know, I sometimes ask my students, do we remember Holden Caulfield? And you know. I'll tell you why I like Holden so much, apart from the fact that he was a neat guy. He's forever a literary character. Why? Because J.D. Salinger, still to this day, has never released the dramatic or theatrical rights or film rights to The Catcher in the Rye. So Holden is always going to be on the page, if you will. Now, another fundamental quality, and again, we're looking at the obvious, or at least I am, about dramatic character is the character must have his or her drama. What could be more obvious? Now, a person who knew a great deal about character, Luigi Pirandello, wrote a play called Six Characters in Search of an Author, which is a lot of things, but among them, an inquiry into the nature of character and the difference between stage characters and live characters, or even us. And so Pirandello says the dramatic character must have his drama. And the characters in Six Characters in Search of an Author must have their drama. It's their vital function. They need it to survive. It's their life. So characters in plays tend to have conflict, something at issue, something at stake, something that can be played out in that now of the 2 to 3 hours. Now, Aristotle's point of view was that the plot was the most important of the dramatic elements, a superseding character, to be sure. As a matter of fact, his point of view was that character served the plot, was appropriate to the plot, enabled the plot, so that characters would have such traits as would make the plot function the way that it should. Now, this is one of the most basic ratios in all of drama, that between character and plot, and what drives the other. Is a play character-driven, or is it structure-driven? And this is a good question, I think. It's so beautifully simple, and yet so wonderfully complicated, and has kept aestheticians busy for a couple of centuries, worrying over plot and character, especially when characters became more about interiority. The philosopher Kenneth Burke developed a system of ratios designed primarily for political and social analysis. He called this system dramatism, which I think is a lovely word for life's processes. But he said that there were five parts of dramatism: the act, the agent, the agency, the scene, and the purpose. And Burke would say that the act requires, of necessity, an agent and an agency and a setting or a situation or a context. So a typical Burkean ratio would be the scene-act ratio. That is, the setting, the situation, the circumstance contains the act, implies the act. Now, what do matters like this have to do with scientific character, or to the situation where the dramatic character is a scientist? That's one question. Another question is, what results when the aesthetics of the drama in some way imitate or mirror the science? And this is the question that most interests me. What happens when the aesthetics of the drama are mirroring some kind of scientific process? Now, playwrights want to create dramatic structures that seem lifelike, unobtrusive, don't call attention to themselves. They create a universe. It may be a very familiar universe, it may be bizarre, but the rules of that universe are consistent, at least hopefully so. If a dramatic structure is overly causal, if A leads to B, leads to C inexorably, we say, well, that's all very nice, or that's all very tragic, but isn't life more random than that? Isn't life more uncertain than that? Now, I think there are plot types, and we've talked about some of these already yesterday, for science-oriented plays. One plot type, I think, is the journey towards discovery that we've seen, I think, a fair amount of times. Also, there's what we might call the dilemma plot, which I think is another fairly common plot in science-oriented drama. For instance, what if the interior workings of the atom are being studied and deciphered at the same time as the fissionable properties of an isotope of uranium are also being worked out? Let's put that contingency into wartime, and we've got a high-stakes situation, which obviously is a great deal of the plot structure or the idea structure of Copenhagen. Now, with the science character, or the scientist as dramatic character, certainly that character can be a neuroscientist or a chemist or a biologist or any one of a number of scientists. But I think with dramatic structure, and I'll be very interested to hear what you have to say about this, physics has a particular application. And the progression of things, the causality of things, the ratios and balances among constituent elements. These, I believe, are elements of theater aesthetics or drama aesthetics, as well as physics. Now, Copenhagen is, I guess, a dilemma plot. You know, I don't mean to be reductive because I greatly admire the play. But I think a great part of Michael Frayn's achievement is to create a play in which the science is mirrored through the characters. Not just that Niels Bohr is one of the characters or that Werner Heisenberg is, but the science itself is part of the dramaturgy. So what is causality? What is history? What is dramatic progression if you're dealing with scientists as characters or with a particular science as the context? I'll wrap up with one final ratio, and that is, I guess, one of the most fundamental of all. It's the ratio of the individual character to the group. Again, what could be simpler? The individual to the dramatis personae. This is where drama began, incidentally, in ancient times, when the single character, the single actor, first separated away from the Dionysian chorus and began to play a role. Drama began, too, in the Greek situation with a very consciously cosmological orientation. Then it was about the gods and what are the great powers that govern our lives and what is my relationship to those powers. But in the larger purview, in the transhistoric purview of tragic drama, the question continues of what is cosmos, what is chaos, what is our relationship to larger forces. Another beauty of dramatic character is that dramatic characters need one another. They not only need their drama, they need each other. What would Niels Bohr be without Werner Heisenberg? You see, so you look at the list at the beginning of the play, and there's the drama. There's the latent drama among those people. Nobody else is going to come in. That's the formula for the play's action. Now, within the total dynamics of the dramatis personae, what can change, what may change when the characters are scientists or when the subject is science? Moreover, what is the aesthetic approach necessary? The aesthetic approach necessary if the drama is to adequately reflect the science. And this is what I am most curious about, and I'm going to leave the question right there. But we've already talked quite a bit about the degree to which these plays are about science or not. But I think a key question is the ratio, the relation of the aesthetics of theater. How does drama work? What is it based on? And the science that might be at issue. Lauren?
I'm going to be walking around, so I have to sit on this table. I also teach high schoolers playwriting, so if I start talking to you like high school students, forgive me. A couple things to start out with, a couple ground rules for this 10 minutes. I'm a playwright, so I'm going to be talking from the playwright's perspective, the creativity involved in making the decisions about a science play, not just kind of analytical or themes in the history of science, which some of my panelists will be going into. Secondly, I'm dealing with the big scientists, the famous ones, the buzzword scientists, the Einsteins, the Newtons, the Galileos, up to Heisenberg and Bohr and all of them, because that's what I've tended to find most intriguing, as opposed to the proof scientists or the scientist in Penny's play, which are made up, but lovely nonetheless. And the third little bit that I'm dealing with is the confluence or the synchronicity of stories in storytelling and metaphor, specifically from the scientist angle. So science stories and science metaphors as they exist in science plays. So taking that, for me, as a writer, when you're looking at what intrigues you, because you have to be interested in what you're writing or else it's going to be rather flat. So what I found most interesting when I started approaching the sciences as themes for plays is the stories, is the history, starting with what Newton was thinking when he was 24 years old and was home from Trinity College because of the plague and had a year and a half to just sit in his house. And after that, ended up with calculus, optics, all of the gravity, among other things, not to mention alchemy and religious studies and knowing several languages, what that looks like on stage. That, to me, was the most interesting because that's mysterious, it's dramatic, and it also has that based on a true story thing that intrigues people as well. So, also, several of my other plays are about historical people. One's about Da Vinci. I have an Einstein-ish one. They're all right here. One on cosmology, which was actually written about a living scientist, which that's a whole other discussion we can have about meeting the scientist that you've written a play about. Know way too much about what he has to say to you. So anyway, the themes that I had discovered when you're looking at these big scientists is the goal of a science play when you're writing about somebody like Einstein, the surprise at the end is not that he's a genius. We all kind of agree on that. That's not the big twist. The big thing is that he's human and that he's a father and a husband, philanderer sometimes, and a teacher and all of these crazy things, a musician. Those are the things that really fuel drama because what we're watching is not ideas. We're not watching general relativity when we're watching a play on Einstein. We're watching the scientist, the thinker, the person who somehow was able to put these ideas together. As well as with all of these people, what is Da Vinci thinking when he's like, okay, I think that'd be a good painting, I can do that. You know, that's a pretty cool idea just to have, much less to put in front of people and to experience as an audience together that moment. Part of what happens to me when I approach these plays is I tend to highlight the scientist as a younger person before they are the Newton that we see in his kind of craggy later years and grouchy and, you know, just this behemoth of science. I wrote a play about him when he's 24 and he's a little neurotic and he's not very cool. He has trouble talking to people and he's very picky and he's mean, he's vicious. And that to me is much more interesting than when we all know the Newton that we all know. So part of what that lets me do is to see them for their humanity, to see them interact, to watch Newton figure out what he wants to eat. And that's fascinating to me. What that leads me to, though, is the people around the big people. So if you have a play about Newton, the best moment, this is my Newton play, it's called Leap. The best moment comes right before the intermission. Heading towards Act Two, when there's a racket, somebody's knocking on the door, and Isaac's mother shows up. And there's a palpable response in the audience when he just says, "Mother?" And everyone goes, "Oh." It's hilarious. Every night it happened. And so that really, it really speaks to this idea of, I think Newton had a mother? How do you think about that? You know, oh wow, she's mad at him. My mother gets mad at me. How do you discipline Isaac Newton? Well, you don't think about that. But that's the joy of what can happen on stage when you treat these people as actual humans. Another version, when you deal with these side characters, like Newton's mother, Newton also in this play has a friend and kind of servant person who Newton has to deal with when he's in his head, and the creativity that's embodied by two other characters in here happen to be two young girls, who they kind of are responsible for his brain and his passion, and then Lucas, his servant, comes in and he has to deal with this actual person living in the real world and seeing that shift from heady science to what I want tea, what I don't know, give me something to drink. So that leads towards the just the fascination of who these people were, how did they get to where they are? And as a dramatist, that's where I find, again, because the big surprise isn't that Newton discovers gravity, but what he's like, what that moment looks like when that thought occurs. So moving towards the story, I mean, moving from the story towards the metaphor, because plays, again, like I said, aren't about ideas, they're about humans, and they can end up with ideas and promote themes, but you're really dealing with people walking around the space and in front of you. The science as metaphor comes in both in structure and in content. And so as a writer, you can think about using the science, let's say Newton's science, for instance, in this play, the metaphor. Let's see in background. Background is a story about a cosmologist who is denied credit, and that's the big dramatic conflict, is he wants his credit, and this is a true story. But the play is metaphor. The metaphor for the science comes in the structure of the play. It goes backwards, like the study of cosmology. Alfer, his name is Ralph Alfer, by the way, and the process that he used to study cosmology starts where he is now in this present time and moves backwards towards the beginning of time. Because again, you can't start at the beginning because that's where everything breaks down. You can only get so far. So the play mimics that by starting actually at the moment of his heart attack and moves backwards in time. So that's, again, it's like Penny's play last night, kind of experiment exploded. It's this idea of Schrodinger's cat, but on a human level. And this is the same way, that idea of studying something put in a character form. So that's structure, but then content, and this is something that's been interesting because we've had a discussion in terms of what the intent of the science in these science plays are. Do we teach, do we just kind of say, here's a cool idea if you want to read more about it and get some actual answers, or you know, how do we direct that? In background and in Leap, I have had the impression of putting the science up front so you hear exactly what calculus sounded like coming out of Newton's mouth. You hear what cosmology and the discovery, or his mathematical prediction of cosmic background radiation sounds like. It's a lot of numbers, it's rather impenetrable, except especially when you've never heard it before, but it's in the play, so that it gives credit to these people who understand it, kind of complimenting, say, see how confusing this is? He actually gets it. and that is a revelation to the audience. So it's not, again, just about these big metaphors in terms of simplifying the science so that we can see it come about, but also hearing what it actually, the words that that scientists use, the language that they use, because I think that's very important. If I was writing a play in Germany, I would like to have some German in there just so we can know what that sounds like. And it's the same way with the language of math and physics. And the final thing, because I could just go on and on, based on a couple of Bill's statements about disguising the art, and I think that references the structure and content, that as a writer, we don't want to say, do you get the metaphor? Get it? It's like relativity, see? So we have to implant those with human experiences because that's what we relate to and that's how you can disguise it. There's several moments in Leap where one of the young girls is gradually falling in love with a cranky Isaac Newton, and she tries to lure him in with references to optics, talking about there's all these colors of love, all in one white word. There's all of these colors. There's romantic love and patriotic love. And Newton's like, okay, I'm thinking optics. And she's going, okay, it's like when something's attracted to each other and they're each pulling on each other, attracting. Get it? Get it? Get it? And he's thinking gravity, and she's of course thinking, kiss me, kiss me. So again, that's kind of another way of disguising the science by using something that most of us have probably felt, unrequited love. And then the final thing would be about the action, because a play is again about what happens, not just who's in it. The action, for me, that's most interesting when you're dealing with these big characters is the moment of discovery, what that looks like, what it sounds like. Is it quiet? Is it just, wait a minute, let it happen? Or, you know, is it big? Is it, oh my gosh, I have to tell someone? Or is it, you know, is it an active thing? Is it So I think that's part of what's interesting to me as a writer is to figure out how to let the actor have that moment and how that plays out and how really impressive that is, because that's one thing that not everyone has, is a moment that's that important, that feels it's completely yours. Newton had this thought and he hadn't told anyone and it was his. And for a brief moment of time, or in my play about a year and a half, it was just his idea and what the enormity of that is for the rest of the world. So anyway, me chatting. Thank you.
Heard properly. The recent spate of plays featuring scientists and the resulting debates concerning the accuracy of those depictions raised larger theoretical questions. Specifically, what is the nature of historical representation in literature, and what does it mean to represent a historical personage on stage? Or to reframe the question, imagine protagonists from a dozen different plays, each called Albert Einstein, each one diverging further from what we know of Einstein's life and thought. And of the final three, one is a poorly drawn caricature, another is a man lying on a Caribbean beach with very little in common with, though nothing obviously contradictory to, the historical Einstein. Well, the third is merely a shaggy figure at the edge of the stage who is little more than a mane and a name. And these are not simply hypothetical questions, given the situations present in Friedrich Dürer Nemat's absurdist play, The Physicist, set in a madhouse in which two of the characters believe they are Einstein. Or the avant-garde opera Einstein on the Beach. At what point do we say of a personage, that's not Einstein? And more importantly, what are the implications of such a claim? Physicists do not normally attract the ideological intensity associated with other historical figures like monarchs, nor do they typically say or do outrageous and theatrical things that the absolute rulers and frustrated playwrights do, though I haven't read your play, maybe your Newton does. So I hope I'll be forgiven if I expand my focus a bit to describe some of the range of historical, quasi-historical, and pseudo-historical representations of actual people. We may begin with some general comments on the nature of characterization. In an article published some years ago, I argued, as indeed James Phelan had also argued a bit earlier, that characterization involved three fundamentally different components. I call these a mimetic drive that seeks to present typical or actual persons or person-like entities, an ideological component that treats characters as instances of competing ideological positions, and an aesthetic design that produces a narrative economy and aesthetic symmetry among the actions of the figures on the stage. Thus, in Shakespeare's first part of Henry IV, the character of Hotspur can be compared to historical accounts of the actual Henry Percy, who was in fact older than Prince Hal's father, and certainly less colorful and definitely less honor-driven than Shakespeare's version of the man. His ostensible ideological function is to dramatize, at the very least, the folly of impetuosity that is untempered by wisdom. While there's a deeper ideological thrust showing uncomfortable parallels between the rebel leader and the sitting king. The main aesthetic function of the figure is to provide, through an elaborate system of parallels and oppositions, a suitable foil for Prince Hal. Indeed, Shakespeare no doubt changed the age of his Hotspur and made him many years younger, not because he was ignorant or confused about the historical facts, but to produce more effectively this aesthetic pairing of comparable opposites. These are the kinds of interpenetrating concerns we need to bear in mind when discussing any characterization, historical or otherwise. August Strindberg's historical dramas are often at considerable variance from the facts of history. His play, Gustav III, is almost as reminiscent of Shakespeare's Richard II as it is of biographical depictions of the Swedish king. Still more wayward is his depiction of the monarch in the play Queen Christina, about Sweden's 17th century lesbian queen, a figure about whom Strindberg felt extreme fascination and repulsion. Quote, "Christina was so genuine a woman that she was a woman hater," he wrote in his open letters to the Intimate Theater. 30 years ago, the life of Queen Christina was again performed on stage, this time in Pam Jem's play. Though it covers much of the same territory, it is equally inaccurate historically, setting forth a character that sounds much more like an early 1970s feminist than a figure from the 17th century. In both plays, ideological concerns vanquish mimetic pretensions. In what many might consider an exquisite act of literary historical revenge on the playwright who so thoroughly violated the known facts of the historical figures he depicted, modern Swedish author Per-Olof Enquist constructed a play about the historical Strindberg. his estranged wife, Siri von Essen, and her lesbian lover, Marie Caroline David. The play Night of the Treebods centers on a difficult rehearsal of Strindberg's short play, The Stronger, which they were mounting, actually, in 1889 in, where else? Copenhagen. The work is often referred to as a documentary drama, and Enquist drew extensively on Strindberg's writings, especially his autobiographical volume, A Madman's Defense, as well as, most interesting for our purposes, Strindberg's partially autobiographical play, The Father. After Enquist's drama opened in 1973, criticism was intense over the accuracy of the portrayal of the historical Strindberg. Extremely old men who had known the playwright wrote long letters to newspapers claiming that Strindberg was not at all like the figure of the play. Based on my knowledge of the character of the historical Strindberg, I tend to agree with the old men. The actual Strindberg was much more ambitious, powerful, overreaching, and audacious than the frustrated, hamstrung, neurotic figure created by Enquist. When confronted by these charges, the modern playwright made the interesting but revealing claim that he was not attempting to portray the historical Strindberg so much as his personal conception of Strindberg. My idea of Strindberg. I would say that the play, and it is a brilliant play, attains its aesthetic balance and ideological effectiveness in a contemporary era precisely by eliding ugly historical accuracies. Another paradoxical example suggests itself. Jean Anouilh recounts the story of his picking up an old copy of Augustin Thierry's History of the Norman Conquest of England and relishing the chapter on Thomas Becket, the Saxon Archbishop of Canterbury, and his Anglo-Norman antagonist, King Henry II. He turned the material into a play, Becket, and gave it to a historian to read. Later, when they met again, the historian roared with laughter and pointed out that for over 50 years, it had proof that Becket was not Saxon, but a good Norman who had come from Rouen and who spelled his name Becket with a Q-U. Since a large part of the drama revolves around Becket being of the vanquished group, the play would have had to be entirely rewritten to be at all accurate. But Anouilh had grown to like the structure and development of his story, much more than any pretension to historical verisimilitude. He says, "For this drama, it was 1,000 times better that Becket remained a Saxon," he wrote. "I changed nothing. I had the play performed 3 months later in Paris. It was a great success, and I noticed that no one except my historian friend was aware of the progress of history." Now, to apply these points to some characterizations of a physicist. In the play Copenhagen, many aspects of Heisenberg's character are set forth, and numerous possible motives are explored. But two uncontested facets of his actual character have wisely been left out. First, his notorious ambition. And second, his deep nationalism and affinity for many of the same romantic causes and topoi that the Nazis also enjoyed. My point is that given the type of play Frayn decided to write, these options, however historically accurate they may have been, could not be presented on stage. The former would upset the aesthetic balance since the audience would be disgusted by the blindly ambitious Heisenberg when juxtaposed with the moderate genial liberal Bohr. Likewise, a zealously nationalistic Heisenberg, sanguine about Germany's aspirations and inevitable victory, would not work. In all probability, it would be booed off the stage, and rightly so. To reiterate, once Frayn decided on the type of drama he would construct, a number of genuine historical possibilities ceased to be available to him as a playwright. It would, of course, be a very different situation if Tom Stoppard, or for that matter, Eugene Ionesco, decided to dramatize the story in their own distinctive manners. If I myself were to do a version of the play, to be called, of course, the Heisenberg Variations, I would suggest a far greater range of possible motives, including duping Bohr to pick his brains to please the Reich. After all, he had been his graduate student, so anything is possible. No, I would also add the character of his own graduate student, Karl von Weizsäcker, the son of a high-ranking Nazi diplomat and student of theoretical physics under Heisenberg, who did, in fact, actually accompany Heisenberg to Copenhagen that September. How could Frayn have left this relation untouched? And we may ask ourselves the question posed most dramatically by Ennui. What should Frayn do if, when all of Bohr's and Heisenberg's letters and papers are finally made public, it turns out that his characterization of Heisenberg is all wrong? I strongly suspect that the author will not rewrite his fine play, but merely claim that this is a set of possible events rather than actual ones. Though such a conclusion may trouble some, perhaps it shouldn't. Looking at the conceptually larger issue of the ontological status of fictional characters, sorry for the jawbreaker there, we find there is no insistent and unambiguous referential claim to be made. As Anna Whiteside points out in her summary of recent philosophical theories of reference, quote, when Stendhal refers to Napoleon, Baudelaire to Paris, Chekhov to Moscow, however realist or naturalist their art, they refer not so much to the extratextual primary referent mentioned, but to their own highly connoted intertextual and intratextual literary artifact. In short, there is no actual ontological commitment in literary works. They cannot be falsified in a way a work of nonfiction can be. The author can always legitimately say, well, that's just my idea of the person, in a way that biographers can't when confronted with overwhelming evidence that contradicts their claims. Thus, even in the representation of historical individuals, there is a fundamental poetic license that sets the work apart from non-fictional accounts. This is not to say authors should not attempt to be as accurate as possible, and that audiences should not value such accuracies, especially in the pedagogical dramas, but only that the issues involved are multivalenced and indeed often mutually exclusive. Truth and beauty are not one. As any good playwright will tell you, it's no good to have a perfectly accurate historical play if none of the spectators will stick around for the second act. But this is perhaps only to reiterate that the mimetic is only one of at least three mainsprings of characterization. And even here, as Aristotle noted, history occupies a substantially different order of discourse than does poetry or literature. In the end, it is not falsifiable in the way that fiction, including historical, in the end, history is falsifiable in the way that fiction, including historical fiction, is not. Thanks.
Russ?
Oh. I'm going to stand because I can make better eye contact with you. There was a lot of sort of groveling yesterday about the physicists being intimidated in the presence of so many humanists, but I don't share any of that at all because you should know that when I was a senior in high school, the student government representative to my high school's science club was me. And I spent a whole day at Illinois Institute of Technology learning about computers. I learned that digital didn't refer only to my fingers, and that helped me a lot on my SATs when I took them. I'm going to speak about some characteristics that I think make sense of how science can provide good characters, and a longer list of things where I think the assumption is a little bit misplaced. And I was provoked by a lot of the comments I heard earlier before me. History plays, it's been said, are always about the present. Galileo is not really about the Inquisition, and it's not about a heliocentric or a geocentric world. It's about the present when Brecht wrote the play. I would argue that Copenhagen as well is not really about an historical episode. It has to live in the now, as Bill was saying, present tense. You have 2.5 hours to make this drama that is going to engage an audience that cannot reread a speech, rehear a scene that has just occurred. Playwrights don't write for the eyes of readers. They write for the eyes and ears of audience. They write for the lips of actors. And I think I like the fact that this morning we're paying more attention to the livingness and the present tenseness of theater as opposed to reading it. One of the wonderful characteristics, and so I'm going to talk about some positive characteristics, some negative ones, and I'm going to end, I hope, with a few Feynman anecdotes and a speech, because I also wrote, I think, the first Feynman play about 20 years ago. Eric Bentley wrote a wonderful book called The Playwright as Thinker, an idea that looked at a whole bunch of drama in the 20th century and was a new idea that a playwright could be a thinker as opposed to a feeler or an emoter. And to the extent that scientific individuals are also thinkers, they can be really intriguing source material for playwrights. They are on quests oftentimes. Characters who are seeking something, whether it's knowledge or an answer to a question, is a very active process, and that lends itself well to a drama. We like to see people who are doing things. Sometimes those quests can lead to a realization, an insight, a knowledge, a light bulb goes on, which is also a very exciting thing to experience on stage. Sometimes the character doesn't have that insight. I would say Dr. Faustus in Marlowe is an example of that. He might not have the insight about what is transpiring in his deal with the devil, but the audience gets to be ahead of him and gets to perceive, you know, what those insights are. And that's an exciting experience for the audience. Something that preparing for today led me to realize, I never thought, I ran a theater in Chicago for 11 years, and the mission statement had two parts, the second part of which was, every production is an opportunity to understand the world in which we live, rather than to escape it. Now that may seem really obvious and that sort of, you know, 501c3e's that you like to have for getting grants and so on, but the idea of the theater as a place to understand the world that we live in as opposed to escape it is not necessarily what everyone wants to go to the art or to theater to find. And yet that idea of understanding the world that we live in is obviously something that scientists do. So I see a kindly coincidence there, an overlap there. We haven't yet in the panels today talked about the way that the processes of, some of the processes of science and theater are akin, and I'd like to point out a couple of those. Although plays are usually the work of an individual or sometimes a couple of individuals, the process that results in a production, which is, I would argue, the goal of any piece of theater, is highly collaborative, has many authors. We don't really ever know, did the director do it, did the actor do it, was it in the stage direction, did the idea come from the designer, and we don't care either. It can just come out in the final production on stage. And obviously there are many, many scientific experiments that may have lead authors but have huge teams either on one campus or across campuses collaborating, all working together in some cohesive fashion to end up with their results. Those are some of the positive parallels I find. Some of the negative ones are this, and I alluded to this yesterday in my question of one of the panels. Plays aren't usually, what defines a play is not what it's about, but how it does what it does. It's a way of telling a story. There are narrative ways that you can tell them in paintings, you can have narrative ballets, you can have all sorts of different ways, but it seems to me that content is not really what it is that defines a play. And there's a curious little statement in the sort of summary of what this conference would be about, where it says, central to these observations will be the extent to which scientific concepts are amenable to dissemination in narrative and performance. Amenable to dissemination. So maybe narrative and theater are ways to communicate these scientific principles or truths or ideas or about characters. And that seems to me to be maybe fine for if the purpose is communication or the purpose is to teach people, but plays have a purpose unto themselves. They don't mean to exist for something else. And so I would say that in successful plays, in plays that work as pieces of art, whatever science may exist or the character that may exist who's drawn from a scientific background is really very much at the background of what the event is, rather than ultimately being the foreground of what the event is. And your comments as well about, you know, Einstein and Newton and having a mother and looking at their relationships as being a father or a husband is very much the case. We are stuck with the fact that we have these human representations. And so we are always going to respond most to what we see in them as human beings. We can't, you know, if one of the simple definitions of science is a search for knowledge about nature, we can't really do that in the theater. We don't really explore or look into nature. We look into relationships between people. Let me end with a couple of comments about Feynman. And when Bill sent me the plan for today, and I saw that there were going to be these readings from other plays and other pieces of writing, I had in mind a particular speech that I wrote, and it may seem self-serving to read it at a conference like this, but isn't self-serving what academic conferences are all about anyway? I got to meet Feynman in 1984 when we were doing a play at the Mark Taper Forum called The Genius. And I got permission to use a little essay that he had written about Los Alamos before any of his books were published. And when he first appeared on stage, the character that was based on him, he was just called Scientist. He didn't even have a name. And subsequently, Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman was published, and there was a question of whether or not I could get the rights to continue this work that I was doing with him. And he said, gee, you know, I have this reputation for being a very hard guy to get along with, but you and me seem to be okay, so you can go ahead with this. And I moved to Chicago in 1987 to run a theater there, which I ran for 11 years. And as soon as I arrived, I realized there was a first act to this play. The second act dealt with the Trinity test and life at Los Alamos. And I realized, being in Chicago, that I wanted to write a first act about the first sustained reaction under the grandstand at the University of Chicago. So this play is framed by the Nobel Prize ceremony at the beginning, with Fermi getting his, and then suddenly it cuts and Feynman gets his. And the whole play then occurs, and what I'm going to read to you is a 2.5-minute monologue of Feynman after Trinity. So he's in the desert, and he refers back to some advice that von Neumann gave him about not being responsible for the world you live in. At the beginning of the play, he talks about how this helped him throughout life. But now, having just seen Trinity, he is in the desert and says the following. Monday morning quarterback is the easiest position on any team to play. It has led me to question von Neumann's idea that you don't have to be responsible for the entire world that you live in. When you're doing science, you enter a different world, okay? You're using what you know to imagine what you don't know. You look at the possibilities and filter out some of them, the wrong ones, the ugly ones, but this is very interesting. Not at first. The impossible ones. Solving a problem is a beautiful experience. Like all beauty, it gives pleasure. Original theory is absolutely beautiful because it is unsullied by experimental proofs, only as finite as your imagination's ability to grasp a possibility of possibilities. In the ether of pure science, for finite moments, unexpected and exquisitely profound, a scientist can touch truth. We were children, then students, graduate students, teaching assistants, docs, postdocs, full-fledged scientists, but we were never adults. Rabi called us the Peter Pans of the human race. They never grow up. They always keep their curiosity. They get carried away, too. You see, what happened to me, what happened to all of us, is we started for a very good reason. Then you're working so hard to accomplish something, and it's pleasure, and it's excitement, and you stop thinking, you know? You just stop thinking. Leo Szilard was one of the few who kept thinking, and he was ostracized for it. When I was young, when I was single, I thought science would make good things for everybody. It was obviously useful. It was good. It was fun. After the war, I worried about the bomb. I didn't know what the future was going to look like. I certainly wasn't sure we would last until now. Therefore, there is one question that I have. Is there something evil in science? Put another way, what is the value of the science I had dedicated my life to? The thing I loved when I could see that it could do such terrible things. Have you ever done something wrong in your life? Well, worse than being wrong is the belated awareness that you didn't even bother to consider the possibility that you might be wrong. Atomic bombers and their bomb, our bomb, my bomb, ended the war. Peace came to the world around me and to the world within me, head, heart, conscience, consciousness. Yes and no. Is Mr. Feynman joking? I wish I were.
Chris?
I'm going to come at this from yet another different perspective, and that is of a very pragmatic theater maker. I produce plays. About 7 years ago, I had the good fortune, through the largesse of the Sloan Foundation, to really begin a very intimate, ongoing exploration of... I began a very intimate and ongoing exploration of exactly what this topic is about. I was charged and ultimately helped commission, develop, and produce about 75 plays exploring the worlds of science and technology through the EST Sloan Project. And now, as the artistic director of the Magic Theater in San Francisco, I've gotten another grant from them to continue this ongoing exploration, where the central purpose is to provide artists with the opportunity to understand and mine the rich vein of stories that the scientific and technological worlds hold for us. So I'm genuinely, practically interested in the nature of what is a scientist as a dramatic character. I also really appreciated what everybody has said up here, and I'm going to actually kind of work a little bit backwards, because Russell said something that I've been thinking about a lot, which is the parallel, really, between the scientific process and the artistic process. There are a tremendous number of parallels, but there is a absolute and fundamental difference, not in purpose, but in kind of a methodology of purpose. If you accept the thesis that both scientists and artists are in fact trying to find the truth and somehow communicate it, present it, understand it, in whatever realm, the fundamental difference is scientists are really trying to find an objective truth, a verifiable and repeatable truth. And in fact, the greatest precept of the scientific process as it's understood is whatever you do must be able to be repeated in order to achieve its outcome and its proof. Whereas in art, what you are looking for is the subjective truth. In fact, that which is wholly original, that which touches the universal chords and yet is completely new. Seeing art that is redundant is not compelling at all. And art finally has a couple of obligations. It has to be compelling. It hopefully will be illuminating. And it certainly has to be entertaining. And by entertaining, I don't mean laugh like a sitcom. I mean it has to be able to hold your attention. So scientific truth has none of that obligation, but it does have a much harder, more rigorous component, which it has to be verifiable. Why is this important? Well, again, in very practical measures, I've encountered three areas of concern when creating scientific characters through the many plays, readings, productions I've participated in. One which was touched on in some length and is a fundamental concern is the balance of historical truth versus poetic truth. As an artist, I'm going to side very heavily on the notion that poetic truth in the realm of art triumphs. It's not a competition, it's really merely pointing out a dialectic that any artist writing about the scientific endeavors has to struggle with. If it's a bio play, if it's a play about a historical character, you are going to be dealing with that balance. This is transparent. I think a lot of people have spent a lot of time thinking and talking about it. In our instance, where our fundamental charge is to create great theater, not to champion a particular scientific theory or a particular person, the notion that an artist is somebody who will interpret events, who will in fact bring their very personal perspective to an event, self-select, make choices about what's important to be shared in order to achieve their own personal version of truth becomes very significant because, of course, as we all know, we have to deal with a lot of compression on the stage in time, action, place, character, dialogue, everything else that we're dealing with. Historical truth versus poetic truth. Exposition. Whether it is very naked, whether it is craftily hidden, dealing with a lot of communicating, a lot of information, oftentimes to people who are not as informed about the information, is one of the potholes that derails most writers working in the scientific arena. How do you explain relativity? How, in a very different instance, do you explain superstring theory? I've read about it a lot. I've had a lot of people explain it to me. I certainly don't get it. I get certain concepts of it. I don't know that Brian Greene entirely gets it. But it's out there, and again, it is a phenomenal metaphor to be searching for a unified field theory. But in the course of a play, how do you communicate what needs to be understood in order to get at the dramatic action? And it's often a challenge. One of the things that I recommend to many people is a little confusion is a good thing. When you watch, or anybody watches, ER, it's actually most compelling when everybody acts like they know what they're doing, speaks in acronyms. For those of us who are not in the medical profession, I wouldn't know if they're accurate or not. But they believe it. They're not stopping to explain it to me. And they're moving forward, and I actually get engaged with, oh, they're trying to save a life. That's the drama. Not whether the cathode has to pierce a certain artery in a certain way to accomplish a certain measure of technological components to achieve its end result. I'm not at a lecture. I don't need to know all of those components to in fact grasp what I do need from it, which to get at the poetic objective. They're trying to save a life. Ah, there's drama. There's conflict, there's objective, there's all those fundamental components of theater, of storytelling. The one that's actually the most interesting to me of the three, so we've got into the historical truth and poetic truth, we got into the nature of dealing with exposition, and I'll just touch on this briefly, is the paradoxical dynamic between what is really essentially the same tool we're using. And I call this beyond the lab coat. There's a pejorative in the theater world, and that is stereotype. There is a term that explores the same region that is held in a positive light, and that is archetype. Somebody puts on a lab coat, we automatically, as human beings who've had interactions with the whole notion of this, are dealing with character archetypical modalities. that we have to embrace. One of the most interesting things about great works of art that deal with the areas of science and technology is when you pierce the stereotype and when you move beyond archetype to something original. It may be very simple, like, oh my God, Newton had a mother. It may be something more human that simply, I'm sure Einstein was very confused and lonely at a certain point in his life. That's why it is actually awfully compelling, usually, to go back to the younger days of a lot of accomplished icons in a historical way, because that's often the time when they are most vulnerable, confused, and searching. So how do we balance stereotype? How do we take advantage of archetype? And how do we get at something which is fundamentally the real issue here, something original, something illuminating about character? Well, that's mystical. There is no pure formula for moving into that realm where an audience goes, aha. Not the person on stage in the eureka moment goes, aha, but the audience is transformed in some way by witnessing a human being, whether they are in the status of a god, as an Einstein might be or a Galileo might be, or whether they're being presented in a very humanistic fashion. Because finally, the obligation of theater is to move audiences and to tell about the human condition, rather than ultimately to lecture or to be a museum piece. We have other forms of communication that do that far more effectively. So historical poetic truth, exposition, and then balancing and piercing the paradox of stereotype and archetype. And there are many more things I could talk about, as could everybody else. But those are things that interest me.
Thank you. Let's take a minute to welcome the other room back into this room, and then we'll move towards our next talk.